Up next on Boston Public Radio, everything you wanted to know about the polar vortex, actually probably more. Then we'll ask how you're coping psychologically with this unending frost. Then Globe editor Brian McGorry joins us to talk about a prominent new hire and a final call he got from Tom Menino. Then, on the tales of the hellish healthcare.gov launch, we talk to an ER doc turned IT pioneer on saving the medical industry and lives with a few strokes at the keyboard.
A new $59 watch, aptly named Ticker, claims it can predict when you're going to die. So, do you want to be reminded every time you look down at your wrist or not? Then our new TV expert, well, our regular TV expert, Bob Thompson, on binge TV watching and a phenomenon that's become a smash surprise hit, slow TV. You hear Bob explain it, you'll wish it were here. That's up next on Boston Public Radio 89.7 WGBH. Jim Browdy, I am Marjorie Egan. You're listening to Boston Public Radio, 89.7 WGBH.
Hi there, Marjorie.
Hey, Jim.
So how many times in the last couple of days has someone said, cold enough for you? Yeah, it's a corny icebreaker, so to speak. But the deep freeze that's taken over the country in New England has also taken over the water cooler buzz. Everybody's talking about the polar vortex, coastal flooding, climate change. We're going to try to wrest this conversation away from lay people like us for some real science. And then, in a few minutes, we want to take your calls on this freezing weather and how you're coping with it psychologically. But first, we're joined by WGBH's science editor. Her name is Heather Goldstone. Heather, thanks so much for joining us.
My pleasure.
Hello, Heather. Thank you for being with us. So let's talk about the two things everybody is just talking about nonstop, and you can explain them to us certainly better than we can. Polar vortex. Please detail.
Yeah, this term, I think, it's nothing new. The phenomenon is not new. The term is not new. It is a real term. It's not something that just got made up. But somehow this term has just caught on like wildfire over the past week, whether it's social media or what, driving it. But really what it is that up at the North Pole, you've got extremely cold air hanging out over the pole, and the temperature difference between that really cold air and the warmer air to the south sets up this circle of really strong westerly winds. We're talking like 100 miles per hour sometimes. And those winds are like a wall, and they just hold that cold air over the pole, usually. But if you get some rapid warming over top of the pole in the atmosphere over the pole, which we did last week, and that does occasionally happen, those winds get weaker, and that the wall kind of crumbles, and that cold air can leak out. And in addition, when that polar jet stream, which is really what it is, when that polar jet stream weakens, our jet stream picks up some of that extra energy and goes into this extra loopy configuration. And so you put the two of those together, and you've got this mass of cold air that started leaking down from the pole, and the jet stream took this dive and has just pulled all of that cold air right down into, you know, well into the southeast, as we've seen this week.
But Heather, I cannot tell a lie. I've never used the term, nor have ever heard the term polar vortex. How often does this happen? How often does it spread into our midst?
Well, you know, it does happen, and I don't know the exact frequency, but one of the interesting things is while climate deniers have been saying, you know, oh, this is just proof that there is no such thing as climate change, look how cold it is. In fact, if you want to add another great term to the mix, there's a name for this as patterns like this have become more frequent, particularly in the past 5 or so years. We've seen this happen a couple of times. You may remember, I think it was 2011, we had another cold snap, and it snowed almost every week for about 6 or 8 weeks. And
yes,
it was similarly because we had warm air up at the Arctic that pushed the cold air down on us. So it's certainly not unprecedented, and the Arctic paradox, as it's been called, is
I love that.
Isn't it great? I think it's even better than polar vortex.
That
personally.
Is 10 times the Arctic paradox. Is that what it is?
Yeah, the Arctic paradox, and that's the term that caught on back in 2011 to describe this. And basically what it is when you get the Arctic is warming twice as fast as the rest of the globe because of when the ice melts, what you expose is dark water underneath it. That absorbs more heat. It sets off this warming cycle. And so as a result, you get this weird flipping where the Arctic is warmer, it's colder down here, and that's because of climate change. And so they call that the Arctic paradox.
So this is definitely linked then to climate change, or most likely linked to climate change.
Right. I mean, climate scientists are very careful not to link without a lot of evidence, which it takes a lot of analysis to come up with that evidence that any one weather event is linked to climate change. But what they are increasingly saying is that this kind of pattern is something that we might expect to see more of and have seen a few times in the past few years.
So if we experience the, I'm trying to use Arctic paradox in a sentence, but I can't at the moment. If we are experiencing this polar vortex, that I can do now, is it likely that it'll recur this winter, or one can't make those kind of predictions? It's a case by case kind of deal.
You know, I think it is kind of a case by case deal, and it tends to be something that can be predicted on the order of days to weeks, perhaps, when one of these flips with the warmer Arctic and colder below that, when that's going to happen and how long it might last. But, for example, the long-range outlook for this winter that the National Oceanographic and Atmospheric Administration put out back in November was calling for a milder winter. But they said, you know, this is based on our long-range forecast, and we can't predict what's going to happen at the scale of days or weeks. And so we're not really seeing that mildness bear out right now, because this is not something they could have predicted back in November.
So Heather Goldstone, I know climate scientists have to be very careful, and you are a climate scientist, and you get a PhD in ocean science from MIT, so you're a pretty smart person there. I mean, you think this is happening?
Well, okay, so I'm not a practicing climate scientist, but but absolutely.
This meaning climate change, I should have
there
said.
There is overwhelming evidence that climate change is happening. There's really in the scientific community no debate about the fact that it's happening. There are certainly things that we don't fully understand and that we can't totally predict. And I would say that this is kind of one of those, that 5 years ago, the predictions coming from climate scientists were that we would probably expect to see, on average, milder winters, right? Warmer temperatures, and that's what we would mostly expect. But increasingly, as we've learned more about it, what scientists are saying more and more is, well, we're going to see extremes, more extreme weather, and that'll include more cold extremes as well as more warm extremes.
Okay, well, let me ask you, Heather Goldstone, the question I always ask anybody with the expertise that you have. So I am like a nervous wreck now that what we're going to be anticipating is...
You should tell her that you and your sister have a house
well,
on
we
Cape
do.
Cod
we
in
do.
The spirit
not,
of full
not
disclosure,
near,
Marguerite.
Not near the ocean, but all of Cape Cod is close enough to the ocean. You spend a lot of time down at Woods Hole there in Falmouth.
Yeah, so, I live in Falmouth, 2 miles from the beach.
Okay, okay. So Heather, you're probably a nervous wreck like I am, that pretty soon you're going to be underwater. There down in your lifetime on 2 miles from the beach in Falmouth. Meanwhile, up here in Boston, parts of us will be underwater too, but the rest of us will be in 5 degrees in January and February forever, that this is going to be our life. Should I calm down about this, or should I be a bunch of a nervous wreck?
Well, see, I personally am in a good situation here in Falmouth. I'm on a hill, and so if anything, I'm just going to have waterfront property.
Okay. okay.
So I don't worry about that as much for my own self, but certainly I think a lot of the predictions are quite scary, and I actually spend a lot of time asking other climate scientists how scared they are and how they cope with it. And at times I've had scientists really, you know, come clean with me and say, you know, I'm completely freaked out that my children will never see a coral reef, that by the time they're adults, we just won't have coral reefs to go and see. The ocean will be too hot and too acidic because of this. And I've talked to people who do have contingency plans if, you know, everything hits the fan. But I think
Like what? Going to Iowa?
You know, it's hard to know what it would be. But it's not necessarily like Iowa is going to be free from impacts either. They're going to see droughts. They're going to see extreme weather. It's just going to be different. I think everybody's going to be impacted in some way. But on the flip side of that, there are also a lot of people who are very confident in human beings' abilities to adapt and innovate. And that doesn't mean we're going to stop it. And it doesn't mean it's going to be pretty, but it's quite possibly not going to be the end of the world. It's not going to be the end of human beings.
Yeah, those people who have confidence are the same people who think Congress is doing a good job. Heather Goldstone, the 9%. Hey, before you go away, I heard you cite, you know, tangible, concrete things. Stay with me. Little anecdotal things, I guess. When you mentioned, and I think it was you, I'm sure it was you last night on Emily Rooney's show, that yesterday or the day before, it was the same temperature in Augusta, Maine, and Augusta, Georgia. That to me is paralyzingly frightening. That was you, right?
Yeah, I think I heard that actually on the takeaway yesterday that they mentioned that. But yeah, I mean, we just, you know, that's how far south these cold temperatures have gone. And it's a huge mass of cold air that's sitting over top of us that covers all the way from Georgia to Maine. So we're all getting a taste of it.
Okay, so before you go away, since Marjorie asked you a personal question about the Cape, can you help me, give me a sentence so I can use Arctic Paradox today to impress my friends? And other than saying, wow, that Arctic Paradox is incredible, help me out here. Give me one.
Oh, boy, that's a tough one.
See, I'm having to do me a favor. Email me later, will you, Heather?
I will email you a sentence using Arctic Paradox.
Hey, Heather Goldstone, science editor for GBH. You were great. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
My pleasure.
Heather, for being with us. We should also mention that she holds a PhD in ocean science from MIT and Woods Hole Oceanographic Institution. Thank you again, Heather. Put me down as the people that are nervous wrecks and freaking out. And I'm glad there are some people that are confident. I'm not one of them.
Our number is 877-301-8970. Now it's your turn. We want to know how you've been dealing with this unrelenting cold. If you want to, I don't mean in a practical way. I'm not that interested in your scarf or mittens or your face mask or your goggles. If you feel it'll help to talk about them, that's perfectly fine. I want to know how you're dealing with the psychological stress from this. I don't think I have, I don't think I suffer from seasonal affective disorder, Marjorie, but it is really hard to get through these days. You get to work when you walk from the garage and you've braved, 75 yards of this incredibly painful cold. You then start thinking about what it's going to be like to leave the building. And then I start thinking about when I go out, get some lunch, or have to walk into the Whole Foods or whatever it is. It is really, at least for me, it's really a debilitating thing. And usually, the reason today is not quite as bad for me is tomorrow it starts warming up. But a couple of days ago, when you look at the weather forecast, like from NECN or crack meteorologists, and you see the next day, the high is going to be 14. Mm-hmm. The low is going to be 3 or 2. It is really, really hard. So we want to know, at least I want to know, at 877-301-8970, how are you getting through this and continuing with your normal lives? Or are you just fine? Has it just been a blip on the screen? For me, it has not been a blip. How about you?
I would say I'm a basket case about the
whole
situation.
You are. No, but
yes,
you're worried about the big picture.
I'm very worried about the big picture. I hadn't thought of the coral reefs, and that's really horrible that Heather Goldstone just mentioned that there may not be around decades away. But I'm worried that this is what it's going to be like from now on.
Yeah, but how about small picture? How about getting through today? Yesterday is a better example, because today we know if you get through today, tomorrow is going to be as warm as, 29 degrees or something like that. Do you have trouble getting through days when it is this painfully cold?
Well,
I do.
Yeah, especially if you go walk the dog. You know, it's really a drag to have to walk the dog in this weather. Now, luckily, I have a hair dog as opposed to a fur dog. Yeah. You know, if you have a husky, he really wants to be out there now in weather like this. If you have a hair dog that gets cold, it's not
Tell
so
the
bad.
Story about walking your dog in the snow last
well,
week.
He basically races in and races out in about 7.5 seconds. It's really funny. And they're all freaked out, you know, because their pathways are all destroyed by all the snow and stuff like that. He doesn't like the cold. But it is a weird thing because they're not getting the exercise. You're not getting the exercise. And I used to live in Vermont, in Burlington, Vermont, and there were periods up in Burlington where it did not get above zero for like weeks at a time.
I was with people from Burlington just the other day who said 4 or 5 days in a row, the highest temperature was -4 degrees. Real temperature, not that wind chill thing.
And this is not like a terrible problem, but if you're a serious runner, it is. You can't run in this weather because the air is so cold, it hurts your lungs, no matter how many, maybe there's some new high-tech product someone can tell me about, but even when you put things around your mouth to cover it, the air coming in, it basically hurts your lungs. And so if you're a real serious runner, this is a real drag for you.
Let me put this in another way before we get to your calls at 877-301-8970. I admit I'm a hot weather person. So with that admission up front, when things are warm and nice, almost everything is good in my life. It doesn't even things that aren't so good feel at least okay.
Well, you sort of wax rhapsodic in the summertime.
I do. Gym. But when things are this, winter I don't like, but this kind of coldness is just painful, literally and figuratively. Almost nothing is good. I don't care how wonderful something is in a practical or objective sort of way. The damper that's put on this, but at least in me, by the intensity, the cold is just, it is really, I hate it. 877-301-8970. We're primarily, at least I am, interested in the psychological effect or impact, how you're dealing with that. But any part of how you're dealing with what appears to be near the end of at least this bout of freezing temperatures today is fair game.
We have some climate deniers that are emailing in already.
What is saying?
Climate
what?
Change deniers.
Saying what?
Saying it's all about your politics. You know that Art from West Bridgewater says that like everything else in politics, if it supports your side, it's evidence. If it doesn't, it's an anecdote. And he's saying that he's not at all convinced. He thinks the evidence for climate change is very, very
well. You know
vague.
What the big mistake? You know what the big mistake was? And they attempted to change course midstream. Even though I'm not that interested in pursuing the climate change discussion today, but we can if you like. Is there was cold global warming up front. And the fact that people can't get over the fact, well, if it's this cold, how can this be global warming? And that's why they switched to what I guess is a more descriptive term, climate change, because it's really about extremes and we are suffering. Not just we here. I'm glad Heather Goldstone mentioned this to you. The middle of the country, while they're maybe not dealing, well, obviously with the same issues as the coasts are, look at the weather in the middle of the country. It is just not just now, but the storms, the tornadoes, it is horrific.
And that report came out from the state just a few weeks ago, showing what could happen to Boston.
The floodplain thing?
The floodplain thing, mm-hmm. And it was really depressing. Great swaths of Boston could be underwater, not that far away. You know, it is incredible that here we are building all this new innovation district, the waterfront district, 10 feet from the water. I mean, the ICA is practically on top of Boston Harbor,
isn't it?
No,
it is,
I know. By the way, Tom just emailed in to say he prefers the term polar vortex over Snowmageddon any day of the week. So
well,
I
prefer, if anybody, by the way, we don't have any prizes to give away, but if you can use the term Arctic paradox before I get an email from Heather Goldstone in a sentence, you'll get some sort of praise, at least from me.
Okay, let's go to Emily from Cambridge. What do you think, Emily?
Hi, Emily.
Hi, Jim and Marjorie.
Hey there.
Thanks for taking the call.
Thank you.
And Jim, I love you, but I'm going to have to disagree with you here. I don't think it's as psychologically damaging as you're making it out to be. I actually think 104 degrees is more psychologically damaging than negative 4 degrees. Because in the wintertime, you can just keep putting on layers. You can
turn
up the heat. You can get cuddly. You can drink hot chocolate. You can get, you know, it's a very contemplative, quiet, sweet time. And in the summer, you know, we don't have, a lot of people here don't have central AC. They don't even have good AC. And you're just there.
Maybe the problem, Emily, is I'm not a contemplative kind of guy. I mean, maybe that's – but and I know practically I really do get the notion you can put off clothes or put on clothes. There are only so many that you can take off when it hits 100 or 98 degrees. But it's not for me an objective analysis. It's the feel of it. And obviously the feel – I don't mean literally the feel, but the psychological feel for you is okay. You actually sound happy with this.
Yeah.
Are you?
It's not summer. I actually am more worried for the animals and for the people who have to work outside all the day, like the you know, the trash collectors and the postmen. I genuinely feel for them. I'm genuinely not happy for them.
Then, Emily, do not go away, because we are talking to a guy who's a chief information officer at a major hospital in town about a lot of medical things, roughly in and around 1 o'clock. But he also lives on a farm, and he's going to talk about how he takes care of the animals in cold snaps like this. So stick around. Emily, great call. Thank you so much for sharing it with
us. There's also a big difference between 20 degrees and zero. I mean, you
yes,
can feel it on
is.
Your skin. You can get frostbitten fairly quickly.
But see, you're almost Emily-esque in that regard. It isn't so much the physical feel for me. When you look at the television or you listen to the radio and they say single digit or you see only a digit on the television screen, that is totally debilitating to me. It isn't that that 9 is that much worse than 12, for example, but 9 is one number. And it shouldn't ever be one number, at least in my life. I guess that's where I'm going.
Okay, let's go to Jackson in Portsmouth, New Hampshire. Hi, Jackson.
Hey there.
So I have lived 2 years in Killington, Vermont, and this year I moved back to the seacoast, and I was really ready for a milder winter, but it hasn't been like that. And I've been thinking a lot about getting back up to Vermont and living in that lifestyle, because I kind of missed the harshness of it. And it got me thinking about when I was younger, I read a book by this author named Tom Brown, and he was a survival skills kind of naturalist from New Jersey. And he would go out with this native guide, and he would have them basically condition their bodies to, like, greet the cold as, like, an embracing factor, as opposed to, like, something that would have you, like, wither away. So
have you done that? Have you practiced what Tom Brown was preaching?
Yeah, what I do is, you know, meditation is something I think that, you know, we all do in our own, in one form or another. So kind of what I try to do is, while I'm, you know, experiencing the cold, I try to have, you know, take a moment to reflect on it and actually think about how I do feel, instead of just, you know, this horrible, because it isn't. You know, sometimes you can feel just as amazing in winter as you can in summer. And, you know, I have been affected.
This is WGBH 89.7, your source for local news and talk. We're Boston's NPR news and culture station.
It is an attitudinal kind of thing.
Well,
and I am psychologically weak when it comes to intense cold.
I think you do adapt. We should ask the doctor when he comes in. I think your blood maybe gets thicker or something.
I mean, physiologically.
Yes,
adapt. But
I think
I'm not talking about the physiology. I'm talking about the head thing. And that's what Jackson is dealing with. Jackson, what does he say? Embracing the cold? I'm not embracing. I can't do it.
Well, you have to dress differently.
You
have to have one of those hats that covers your ears.
You're where I'm spending the weekend?
Where are you spending the weekend?
In a Bob house. You know what a Bob house is?
Above the ice fisherman.
Exactly. Yeah. Can you see me ice fishing?
No.
If anybody out there is an ice fisherman or woman, we'd love to hear from you. The lines are full, but when one opens up at 877-301-8970.
Or the people that love to do that ice sailboats, where they get on the sailboats fly across the ice in the summertime.
It's beautiful to look at.
I think it'd be fun to do today, don't you
think? Yeah, I'm sorry. It's just not who I am. And it's not because I don't want to be. It's just not who I am.
I think you need a hat, Jim. You feel differently.
Let's go to, where are we going?
Spencer on Martha's Vineyard. Are you worried about being underwater too, Spencer, or is it just me?
No, we're not too worried about it over here.
Okay.
The west side of the island, we're at a lot higher elevation. So.
Okay.
Like one of your callers said, we're looking forward to some waterfront property.
All right. What do you think about the cold, Spencer?
Well, I like what your last caller said about the mental aspect of it. I'm a shingler, so we're outside right now.
Ah.
And yesterday was really cold, but yeah, if you can mentally handle it, the physical part, you know, you keep your truck running when you feel the frostbite start to set in. You just warm up a little bit.
Okay, wait a minute now. So how do you feel when you feel the frostbite starting to set in? How's that feel?
Well, first you go numb, and as long as you can still pick up the nails, you're okay.
Oh, yeah, that's always been my motto. Even if I'm numb, as long as I can pick up the nails. No, but wait a second. Spencer, there's not a mind over body kind of thing when it comes to frostbite. Frostbite is like a real – I assume you mean that rhetorically. You don't mean literally frostbite.
You can feel it's a pain. It's a sharp, sharp pain, and there's a point where you can't really move your hands anymore.
And you're embracing that just like Jackson did?
I'm not embracing it so much as just handling it, dealing with it. And it makes the next day, like today, feels warm to me.
Well, that part is absolutely, there's no question. So tomorrow or today, when it reaches 26 or whatever it's supposed to do, low 20 something, it is going to feel like being in Miami Beach, balmy, right? But Spencer, thanks for sharing your story with us. We appreciate it.
Judith has just emailed in. She calls us a pair of wusses, she says.
We are.
Could be in Chicago, Syria, or Fukushima, Japan. It's like listening to the Dowager Lady Grantham lament the potential loss of the servant class. That's a great email, Judith.
That is a great
I think you sort of resemble Lady Grantham sometimes, Jim.
877-3, oh my good days, 301-8970. By the way, how healthy were those? Well, I assume those two guys were healthy. I mean, that notion that you can't, I guess you can't change what you can't change. You can do what Emily suggested from Cambridge. You just dress a little more. And if that doesn't insulate you literally or figuratively from the cold, then you have to have their mindset. Embrace it or do something. I cannot. And I've lived in cold. I grew up in Philly. I lived in New York. I lived here. So I've lived in a cold weather climate my whole life. I just cannot deal with level of intensity. 20 is fine with me. Single digits,
well, that's
as I
what
say,
I mean.
Totally
a big difference.
Unacceptable.
There's a big difference. And, you know, a lot of people ski in this weather. And yesterday, I'm sure they had all the frostbite warnings at the ski slopes in New Hampshire and Vermont and Maine. They do have, obviously, in 2013, this great keep warm stuff, the complete mask that covers your face and the mittens, and people get the warmers and all that kind of stuff. But there's something just about being, you know, it's not fun to have the water in your eyes freeze as you're going up the chairlift. That's sort of how
one of the
I
great experiments. I think it was on CNN last night. I'm not sure. Maybe it was from Chicago. It was somewhere in the Midwest. This reporter threw a glass of hot water or hot liquid of some sort in the air. And the water froze while it was still in the air, meaning it was one of the, it sort of like snowed down from the height to which it had been thrown.
Jack has emailed, we're wusses as well, Jim.
So we are.
He said he had to drop his car off to be serviced this morning, walked about a mile to work, 2 degrees, no big deal.
Yeah, no big deal. Guy's
a
probably
mile.
Locked in his basement with
what
a space
are you?
Heater.
Yeah.
Let's go to Cammie in Boston. You're next on Boston Public Radio with Jim Browdy and Marjorie. And Cammie, thanks for the call.
Hello.
Hi.
I'm going to try that hot water in the air trick. I'm with your first caller. I feel for the people who work outdoors and the pets, but I personally love it. You just have to dress for it. And I'm not just talking maybe one pair of gloves. I'm talking two pairs of gloves, a hat, a hood, et cetera. I am amazed at how many people I see waiting for the train that are not wearing hats.
Yeah, hats a huge thing.
That's a big thing.
What percentage of your body heat goes out of your headwear? But I want to get back to your words. I love it. What do you love about it? I understand coping with it. What do you love about it, Cammie?
I really can't say, but I've always been a cold weather fan. I always vacation in the wintertime. I'll take this type of weather over. I like the summer, too, but I enjoy it. I wish there were more days like this.
Now, would you go winter camping? That's another thing I'm not planning on doing anytime soon. Is that?
No, I would not camp.
Okay.
My husband didn't want me to walk to the train. He said, it's a little too cold. I know you like it, but I'll pick you up. And I got into the car and he laughed. He said, all the women in front of you are huddling. Everyone's got their head down. He said, you're just walking along like it's 60 degrees out.
Well, I love that. I mean, that is the attitude I wish I could embrace, but I'm not there. Cammie, thank you for the call.
Thank
this
you.
Is the healthiest bunch of listeners anywhere.
No, listen, I think there's nothing like sleeping in a snowbank. Nothing like it, you know?
By the way, I do have friends. I know the youth social. I have friends who actually love winter camping. Actually, we worked with Hank, who we work with at our prior radio station, went winter camping with his family.
He did.
With his daughters.
He also runs in. He's one of the L Street Brownies that runs in every New Year's
Day
in his bathing suit in the weather. I think what was the temperature of the water this year? It was crazy.
I don't know. It's just whatever. It's ridiculous.
Okay, Jody on the Cape. Are you worried about the Cape being under? Oh, is it JD? I'm sorry. JD on the
Hi,
Cape?
Hi, JD.
Hi, it's Katie.
Oh, Katie.
Katie, I'm sorry.
We got it on the third try. Hi, Katie.
I think the Arctic Paradox is the best thing that's happened to me lately.
Really?
Because I'm also experiencing the menopause paradox. This is sweater weather for me. I can go out in a t-shirt, maybe a light sweater, and I'm happy.
Yeah, every time you get a hot flash, you can just run to the front door, throw it open.
I don't have hot flashes anymore. I'm just hot all the time. So
really?
Yep.
Wow, hot all the time.
She's a lucky woman.
Hot all the time. Yep.
Hey, Katie, thank you for sharing your menopause paradox.
T-shirt weather, I like that very much.
For those who just tuned in, the reason she mentioned the Arctic paradox, had you ever heard the term before Heather Goldstone, our colleague?
Never.
Nor had I. And apparently that happened in 2011. And that came before the polar vortex, which apparently is not new to many people, but was new to me and Marjorie. Let's take one more. Maggie in Uxbridge, you're next on Boston Public Radio. Hey there.
Oh, this is miserable. Even the horses don't like this.
How do I know?
Really?
Yeah, I work in a barn. I am out here all day long. I've got blankets on my dogs. I've got blankets on my horses. It's miserable. It's hard to breathe. I'm out here pounding water buckets with a mallet. Oh, it's just miserable.
Hey, Maggie, so horses, I've seen horses covered in, I don't know what they're called,
blankets
or something. Does that do it? Is that enough for a horse to survive this?
A lot of horses do very well without a blanket because of their hair coat holds in air, and their bodies create heat by warming up the air that their own coat holds in. But we have a lot of older horses, and we have a lot of show horses on our property, so they can't handle it. I've got a couple of horses that have three blankets on.
Wow.
And that's a lot, yeah.
You know, the everyday problems, because people like me are selfish and are worried about how I confront this, but it would never have occurred to me if you work in a barn, as you say you do, and you have to make sure that horses have something to drink. Obviously, the water is freezing all the time. So what are you, are there heaters, or are you just smashing it with mallets all the time, like you said?
Go out and smash buckets with mallets and then carry buckets out there with water and do it a couple of times a day.
And the water's so cold, obviously, for the horses.
Yeah, and it's so
Maggie,
cold, it's freezing so quick.
You know, I wonder, because horses usually are in individual stalls in their barns. Does it help if they can, like, huddle together, or will they even huddle together?
If they have somewhere where they can get out of the wind, they'll do that. And, yeah, they will stand next to each other.
Yeah.
Let one be a wind barrier. If it's really windy, they turn their butt to the wind and let the wind take their hind ends take the brunt of the wind.
That's what I do too, Maggie. I do the exact same thing.
Yeah.
Maggie, thank you for calling. You know, speaking of the horses huddling together, do you remember Vern Locks the other day, our expert
about birds?
What were those birds that huddled together?
He said they roll themselves up into little balls.
Like 12 or 13 of them in a ball.
Inside their chests so that they can breathe warm air. I was thinking about that. Imagine how cold that water is. It's just been de-iced with a hammer.
No, I cannot.
Okay, when we come back, we're going to be joined by Brian McGrory, editor of the Boston Globe. He's going to weigh in on the weather, our new mayor, and a lot of other local news. That's next on 89.7 WGBH, Boston Public Radio.
The New England Center for Investigative Reporting is a new frontier in journalism.
Joe Bergantino is the executive director.
It's a nonprofit investigative reporting newsroom, not beholden to advertisers or the desire to make money, but only the desire to do great journalism, to do great investigative reporting.
The New England Center for Investigative Reporting, now in partnership with WGBH News.
WGBH programs exist because of you and Brown University's pre-college summer programs, where students can prepare for college success, experience college life, and make new friends from around the world. More than 300 courses available. brown.edu/summer. And Chasing Shackleton, follow a modern recreation of Sir Ernest Shackleton's epic transantarctic expedition. The voyage begins in part one of Chasing Shackleton, Wednesday at 10 on WGBH 2.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. I am Jim Browdy. She is Marjorie Egan. We're joined on the phone, as we are every Wednesday, except for the last two, by the editor of the Boston Globe, Brian McGrory. Happy New Year, Brian.
Happy New Year to you, Jim. Happy New Year, Marjorie.
Happy New Year to you too, Brian. So John Henry's at the Chamber of Commerce just this morning talking about making the newspaper aggressively relevant and also talking about something you guys may do in terms of Catholicism with John Allen, the guy from National Catholic Reporter. What's going on?
Well, on the Catholicism front, we outlined that yesterday. I sent a memo out to staff and announcing the hire of John Allen, who is the legendary reporter for the National Catholic Reporter publication, an extraordinary analyst of things in the Vatican, as well-sourced as any English-speaking reporter on Rome. And we are very, very excited to get him here. It's a big, important move for the Globe. As you well recall, we were the paper back in 2002 that really highlighted the issues involving pedophilic priests in the Boston Archdiocese in a story that rippled around the world. And for us now to get the foremost English-speaking reporter on
He's
the Vatican
great.
At a time when there's a resurgence of interest in Rome and in Catholicism, I think is a big get.
I think you should get Pope Francis to do a weekly column myself, but you're the editor. I think
hey,
it's
great.
You
never know. He might do it. He's very busy writing these things.
In your press release yesterday announcing the hiring of Allen, which I think everybody with whom I've spoken said is great for the city, great for you guys, he will also help us explore the very real possibility of launching a freestanding publication devoted to Catholicism, et cetera, et cetera. What would that mean? What might that mean?
It's a good question, Jim, and I was intentionally vague yesterday to some extent, so I appreciate you rubbing right against that.
My pleasure.
Look, we think there's opportunity out there. We think that there is. We live in a city that has a lot of Catholics, and we know for a fact that there is this surge in interest in Catholicism going on, not just here, but around the country and around the world, and we're looking at the possibility of putting up a website that is devoted to Catholicism, not for a local audience, but for a national and even international audience. And we're going to be exploring that very hard in the days and weeks ahead.
Yeah, I apologize, Brian. I thought that Henry had mentioned that this morning, too, but I guess it was...
He did mention it as well.
Oh, he did. Yeah. Oh, okay.
You just portrayed it as an unveiling.
I'm sorry. I didn't mean to say it was the not the unveiling when it wasn't. You know, tell us about this whole thing with this sports section thing you guys are doing, too.
Score?
Yes.
I mean, particularly, I think what Marjorie and I were talking about was the aspect that Henry also, in a speech at the Chamber this morning, mentioned that, you know, it's a sponsored section, and obviously revenues
yes.
matter. I mean, that's the angle we're interested in.
Well, it's not yet a sponsored section.
Oh.
We would like it to be a sponsored section to some extent. And look, it's a beautiful Monday standalone devoted to the Patriots and to the NFL. And we came up with it. Joe Sullivan over in sports, Dan Zedek, our terrific design director. Joe Sullivan is our sports editor. We sat down together and conjured up this image of what would a beautiful, very non-traditional sports section look like that would be devoted to football. And we came up with this. It doesn't look like anything else that the Globe has ever produced. I haven't seen anything like it in another U.S. newspaper. And readers have been gobbling it up. And John Henry's point today was, we want to go out and sell the thing. Readers are devoted to our sports coverage, and that's where advertisers should be as well.
Did you hear about this? I just heard about this morning, Brian McGroy, this thing that the New York Times is doing where they've got this paid post from Dell, a story about millennials in the office, and it's got a little when you bring up the story online, the headline is, "Will millennials ever completely shun the office?" You see this little Dell insignia, and at the bottom of the piece it says, paid post from Dell, more paid post from Dell. That's what they're doing. They're running sponsored articles.
They have tipped their hand that they're going to be going in that direction. I haven't seen this one specifically, but look, you know, Marjorie, I think you know this as well as anybody. We are always going to be devoted to the journalistic mission at papers like the Herald and the Globe and the New York Times. There's no question about that. But if we continue to ride around on our high horse talking about advertising and how there needs to be, you know, such a thick delineation that, you know, we don't make any progress on that front, then we're going to be riding around empty newsrooms because we're not going to have enough reporters. And like it or not, we're going to have to address advertising in different ways in major publications. And, you know, not believe me, we will never compromise a journalistic mission, but we need to rethink much of what we do in that front.
Now, Brian, I would assume that if John Allen, in your perception, is the premier English language reporter on the Vatican, and I would agree with that. I think Marjorie does, too.
He's a great writer, too.
I assume you would agree. I am the premier English language reporter on all issues relating to Brian McGroy. Would you agree with that?
This is where we start to get scary.
Okay, fine. Now, here's what I did. I had David Filipov from your paper on my television show last night.
He's terrific.
He is terrific. And he was in the office when Menino had his final hour there. And it was a pretty moving story and moving thing. In the middle of the piece, there's a quote in which he says, he, meaning Tom Menino, this is Filipov writing, he placed a call to a local newspaper editor. Well, I did some crack reporting in the last 24 hours. And I am told that that local newspaper editor may have been you. Is that correct?
What do you want me to say?
So what did he say to you? I'm serious. That is really, what did he say to you?
I've known Tom Menino a long time. I covered his first campaign for the mayoralty back in 1993. And we talk quite often. We have had a very interesting relationship, at times adversarial. But I'd be lying if I said I didn't have affection for the guy.
I
think you would say the same thing.
Yes.
And he called right on his way out the door. He often calls and just said, "You're not going to have me to kick around anymore. I'm Joe Citizen now." And, I mean, I've been the recipient of a lot of his tongue-in-cheek calls right before he went into Faneuil Hall to announce that he wasn't running again. No reason you would recall this, but I had a front page story that day because I had interviewed him in his office, in which he pretty much said he wasn't going to run again, but he left the door open in case he changed his mind that night. And he called me up literally on his way in and said, "I really want to change my mind, but you had it on the front page, so now..."
That's great.
So Brian, then you have an insight into him that I certainly don't have, and Jim doesn't either. What do you think? Obviously, this is very emotional for him. You saw him bend his head down and actually shed some tears when he was talking to his staffers.
Right? Great photograph by Suzanne Kreider, by
the
way.
Yeah, it was a terrific picture. And the clean desk of the envelope that he left for Marty Walsh and the keys and stuff. What do you think it's going to be like for Tom Menino post the mayor's office?
Well, I mean, first of all, Jim, I appreciate you saying that about Suzanne Kreider, who is a fabulous photographer. And she was given extraordinary inside access for the last few months to Tom Menino's last month in office, along with another extraordinary photographer, Yoon Byun, who was equally terrific. We had a great spread in the Sunday paper. This has been enormously emotional for him, but it's also been, I think, somewhat fascinating. Look, he hates to leave. There's no doubt about that. This has been his life. He's devoted himself fully to it, 24 hours a day. But I think he is truly intrigued by what's to come at Boston University, the ability to travel. He'll be making more money than he was when you throw in a BU salary and a pension, and he'll have a little bit more freedom. So I think he's excited about that. He called me Friday afternoon and said, "I'm calling you from my brand new iPhone. Do you know I can get the Globe on this?"
That is
no
great.
Way. We produce the Globe on the iPhone? You're kidding me. But he's all of this stuff is new to him. Picture being, what is he, 70, 72 years old or something?
Yeah.
And you're just getting behind the wheel of a car again for the first time
no,
in 20
No, he said,
years.
He told us he had only, other than driving to church occasionally, he literally hadn't driven in 2 decades. It's unbelievable.
So while there's no doubt in anybody's mind he is going to miss the mayoralty, look at when you have this new set of challenges ahead of you, interesting challenges, and somewhat of a reinvention at this stage of your life, it's got to be reinvigorating.
Hey, so do you have, speaking of bittersweet, which is the word, maybe it was even in the headline in the Filipov piece, it had to be, I mean this sincerely, are these not the moments where you don't want to write one of your infamous, the phone rang, it's Tom Menino, an hour before he leaves the office? How hard is that on days like that for you?
Look, first of all, the only person they're infamous to is you. I was, in all honesty, dying to be writing about
this. Of course
this.
You were.
Dying. I really wanted to, but I didn't want to get in the way of what we were already doing here. I mean, I miss the keyboard greatly. And on days like that, on weeks like this, with a new mayor who I barely know and an old mayor who I knew well, it would have been a whole lot of fun to be tapping something
Speaking
out.
Of the new mayor, do you, as the boss there, is there an unspoken notion? I don't mean this as a joke, by the way. Is there an unspoken notion that there's a bit of a honeymoon for a new person, that you report on the announcements and one reports on the policy initiatives and that sort of thing? But essentially, we don't get into the underside of people like Marty Walsh. I'm not saying there is any, but you know what I mean. Is there a notion we report the positive for at least a period of time and then we go back to typical reporting?
I mean, it's an interesting question, Jim. I don't think there's a concerted decision made at all. Actually, I know there's not a concerted decision made that, listen, let's just report what's good. I mean, I think we're human over here, and the guy is brand new in office, and we want to see what he can do, what he's capable of doing, what he wants to do, without clouding things with unnecessary negativity right away. But that's not to say if he does something boneheaded, if he appoints a felon or a suspect person to his cabinet or as a main advisor, that we're not going to be all over the case. We are, but I mean, it's a new, it's new. It's a beginning. We're as interested in it as everybody else, and we know that there's a lot of interest in this guy right now.
Yeah, I was a little disappointed when he appointed Gene Flaherty, who had been on the wrong side of the drunk driving reforms and for been an obstructionist for many years, to be his chief legal counsel. He's the guy from Chelsea.
Well, do you remember Gene Flaherty? No reason you'd remember. It's just big in my mind. He wrote me an email once threatening to beat me up.
Well, why don't you tell, then that makes two of us here in this conversation. Why don't you tell your story, Jim
But
Browning?
Mine, I think, was that, first of all, why was he threatening to beat you? What had you written? Was it about Melanie's Law or what had you written?
I had written about Melanie's Law, but evidently I said some things about his mentor, Tom Finneran, the Speaker of the House then, that he didn't appreciate. And sent me an email, and to his credit, he signed it. Representative Eugene O'Flaherty.
Was it intended with humor or was not intended?
Oh God, no.
Because my story doesn't measure up. The story I told Marjorie just yesterday, actually, is at a Democratic state convention years ago. I had been trashing him on the radio nonstop over this Melanie's Law thing. Obviously, for those who don't know the drunk driving law, that the great Ron Bersani, the grandfather of Melanie Pallett, fought for like a decade. He's a wonderful human being and achieved great things. And he walks up to me and introduces himself to me and says something like, and I'm paraphrasing, my wife told me I should hit you over the head with a baseball bat or some such thing, but I've decided to pass. But in all fairness, he said that with a smile on
his face. Well, you had him and some of his cohorts on the front page of the Globe when they took off to Portugal, I believe, before they resolved the issue of the reforms. Well, needed reforms, by the way, in the drunk driving legislation. But anyway, let's...
I recall writing about that, too, because if I remember... I ended up sitting down and having lunch with O'Flaherty and found him to be an oddly likable guy. We kind of hit it off, actually. But when he was in Portugal and we had his photo on the front page of the paper, I had pointed out that he was carrying a man purse at the time and was very worried that somebody who was carrying a man purse had actually threatened to beat me up.
Brian, be careful now, my friend.
No, I mean, the God's honest truth. We ended up getting together after that. He had reached out to me and I found him to be a pretty engaging guy.
Well, I want to ask you about this Jeff Jacoby column on the resolutions for the media. He had a bunch of suggestions. One was that we should stop pretending to be neutral. We shouldn't omit victims from stories about punishing murderers. Either skin color really matters or doesn't. And detoxify the comments sections. Those were the bold-faced headlines in his piece. Any of those you think are worthwhile debating or adopting, or what do you think of them?
Well, before you answer, let me just read a quote from the first one about stop pretending we're not biased. News organizations should be candid about their biases, drop the pretense that they don't take sides. And he's referring to resolutions for the mainstream media, and the assumption is you are mainstream media. What was your reaction?
Well, we are mainstream media. And look, I'll confess, and Jim, Marjorie, we've talked about this before. We do have a bias here, and our bias is against authority, and our goal is to hold people in power accountable for their actions, and we do it whether they are Democrats, we do it whether they're Republicans, we do it whether they're independents. I mean, people who, look, the routine charge against us is that we're a liberal paper, and on the editorial page, there's no question that we are left of center, but for people who say that we only go after Republicans, then they're not reading us, because you need to look no further than this, you know, very liberal Democratic Speaker of the House, Sal DeMacy, and the Globe provided the blueprint for the federal indictment and corruption trial against him that resulted in his conviction, or the State Probation Department debacle, in which the Globe Spotlight team provided the blueprint for charges, studies, reviews, all of that that have resulted in reform. So we do have a bias, and the bias is we like to hold people in power accountable, because if we don't, nobody else will.
Hey, on a much more sensitive note, and obviously wouldn't bring it upward, not for the fact that it now is public, Jeff Jacoby, about whom we just spoke, his son, 11th grader, has been missing for days, apparently. Do you have any news about that?
We are monitoring this very closely here. I happen to be a big fan of Jeff's writing. I think he's I don't agree with his opinions all the time. I think he's an incredibly cogent arguer. And we are monitoring this very closely. Caleb is missing right now. No foul play is suspected here, but our thoughts and hopes are with Jeff and his family.
Ours too. Please convey them.
And readers have read about Caleb in the Globe, because Jeff has often written some very beautiful columns about being a dad and talking letters, basically, to his son.
Extremely eloquent and very popular columns.
Hey, how are you dealing with the polar vortex, Brian McGroy? How's things out in the burbs?
This is where, back as a columnist, this is where I would typically call, like the bartender at some resort in Jamaica, and have him just describe the scene to me and play it out in a column about, you know, people in the pool or people are down on the beach. And I hate this stuff. God, do I? First of all, I hate weather stories. I mean, weather happens. We're in New England. It's just what it is. But the reality is I hate the weather, too. Okay? The older I get, and I'm curious whether you're the same way, the less tolerant I am of this.
Me too. Me too.
I'm rather rugged, Brian, unlike you, so it really has never been an issue
for
me.
Jim has his Tom Brady Uggs on. So
I do, actually.
What a scene that must be.
That's a little fur inside. Hey, you know, I wouldn't have asked you this unless Marjorie brought up the polar vortex, but I thought of you a couple of weeks ago. Obviously, people now are discussing, you know, is climate change part of this polar vortex thing or whatever, you know, whatever it is. Did you see that the Los Angeles Times, I know you're not the editorial page editor, but you are the head of the whole newspaper. Have you seen, did you see the Los Angeles Times has now said they will not publish any letters from deniers of climate change? They use some expression, the publisher or editor said something like letters that don't have a true basis don't get printed. Were you aware of that? Do you know anything about that?
I know vaguely about it, yes. And that's a little bit outside of my bailiwick here, so I can fortunately punt on it. So look, it's an interesting choice by them. I don't think it's one we're ready to make. Of course, I say that, and we could make an announcement this afternoon, but there are still enough people that are arguing this that it's probably worth letting the argument go on, even if we know which side has more validity.
You know, one last thing for me, Brian. We talked about this yesterday.
I knew you were going to raise this, Marjorie. I knew this.
Every Tuesday we have this brilliant, wonderful Nancy Kane on from the Harvard Business School. She's a professor. She can talk about anything. She's a great teacher. And we were talking about yesterday American, not the Brits. They don't like it very much, but Americans' obsession with Downton Abbey. It's like beating the Sopranos in terms of viewership. This fourth season debuted on Sunday night for 2 hours. What did it have, 10 million people tuning in or something?
Million,
astronomical?
Yep, 10 million.
So I just wondered, you're a culture guy. Are you a Abbey head, or are you not an Abbey head?
I have never seen it. I don't even know when it's on. I have no desire.
You're not an Anglophile. You're not into Kate and Wills and the new baby.
No, are you one of these people?
Absolutely.
Are you kidding me? Is she one of these people?
Absolutely.
Hey, you know, but we learned what, since you don't watch that, we learned what the president watches the other day, allegedly. What do you watch television?
Except for Broadside, I rarely, rarely turn, how was that? That was pretty good, no?
It's very quick, Brian, very quick.
I rarely have the time to turn on the TV. Sports.
Got it. Hey, Brian, we missed you. Happy New Year, and we'll talk to you again next Wednesday.
Thank you, guys. I hope you had great holidays, and look forward to talking next week.
Thanks. When we come back, we're going to talk to the Chief Information Officer at Beth Israel Deaconess Medical Center about how doctors can streamline medicine and save lives with a few strokes of a keyboard. That conversation up next, 89.7 WGBH, Boston Public Radio.
On the next Radio Lab.
Blood.
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 We'll have blood.
Blood.
I am in blood.
Blood.
Slipping in this blood.
Blood as an art form.
Baby pacifiers with blood. Nursing bottles with blood.
Blood as a market force.
Almost $300 a pint is what they sell it for.
It's not a commodity. It's a holy substance.
And blood as
that soulful essence that marks you as you and me as me.
It's going to get bloody on the next Radio Lab.
Tomorrow night at 10.
This program is made possible thanks to you. And Gardner Mattress Annual Winter Event. Gardner Mattress, makers of handmade custom mattresses since 1933. More information available at GardnerMattress.com. That's GardnerMattress.com.
And the Massachusetts Teachers Association, reminding you that learning doesn't just happen in the classroom. It happens all day, every day. Working together, parents and teachers can make this a successful school year for every child in Massachusetts.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. I'm Jim Browdy. She is Marjorie Egan. With the rollout of healthcare.gov, a lot of people now have a bad association when they hear healthcare and online in the same sentence. But if done correctly, digitizing medical records and information can streamline treatment and save lives. Here with us in Studio 3 is one of medicine's IT pioneers, Dr. John Halamka. He's the Chief Information Officer at Beth Israel Medical Deaconess Center. He's just been, actually this morning, an hour or so ago, with the governor to launch the second phase of the Massachusetts Health Information Exchange, whatever that is. Dr. Halamka, it's a pleasure to meet you.
Well, very happy to be here.
Yeah, thank you very much for coming in. Well, as Jim just said, whatever that is, what is this new healthcare exchange that you were with the governor talking about this morning? What is it?
So let me give you a personal example. In December of 2011, my wife was diagnosed with breast cancer. She went to a very fine hospital and had imaging studies and was told, we do have an information superhighway in Massachusetts. It's called the Mass Pike. So you can actually take paper copies of your records and drive them around to other caregivers in Boston. I think we would all argue that a newly diagnosed cancer patient...
Someone told her that?
...should never have this happen. Well, it's just the reality of healthcare in America, right? We don't have a healthcare system. What we have is a sick care system. You go to one hospital or one doctor's office, one emergency department, have treatment, but then there is no continuous longitudinal record about your care. So what we launched this morning for the Commonwealth, with the governor's help and Secretary Polonowicz, was showing how a patient, real patient, by the way, with consent, could have records shared electronically in an emergency setting across Beth Israel Deaconess, Atrius, Tufts, and Holyoke. And this is really the first of its kind in the United States. It's truly building that interconnected, secure highway for your continuous wellness, not just episodic sickness.
How's your wife, by the way?
She's doing very well, completely cured, received all of her treatments.
Great.
Things are good.
So... I don't know if reporters asked this question this morning, whether they did or not. Everybody listening is thinking the same thing. Well, there's obviously a huge upside. Every one of us has been to a doctor once or twice or 1,000 times and said, I can't believe I have to go pick up the x-ray or drive and get the record. However, this is all in the context of one of the great technological disasters, at least startup of our time, against the backdrop of healthcare.gov. So why should the average person, including me, not be nervous at the same time that we salivate over the upside of this thing?
Well, sure. And so, of course, many people in the Commonwealth, we're talking payers, providers, technologists, academics, were all engaged in creating this thing, and we built it in a very smart way. State government doesn't actually host any of your records. Absolutely no clinical information is stored centrally. All that's stored is, with your consent, is a pointer to where your records can be found. So in the demonstration this morning, I looked up the patient based on name, gender, date of birth. We had the patient's driver's license and said, there are Beth Israel Deaconess and Tufts and Holyoke and Atrius records. And now, because I'm a doctor and I have secure credentials, I could electronically retrieve data from inside those organizations. So in effect, you're not depending on some enormous website or enormous database. It's a very federated approach.
You know, both times, Dr. Lampkin, interestingly, I know consciously, it sounds like, too, you've said, with your consent.
Right.
Both times, which obviously is a big thing. So let me break that down for a minute. I go to a doctor and I say, it's fine for you to go pull my record from Mount Auburn Hospital, where I practically have a cot, frankly. I'm there quite a bit for reasons that I probably shouldn't be. But in any case...
Some would say it's hypochondria.
But I don't want you to access my records from X location. Can I do that? Can I break it down that way?
Exactly right.
And you
so
can.
The idea is that you, per Massachusetts law, opt in to disclose records at an institutional level. So I'll just give you the example. Suppose I had mental health records at McLean, but I had flu treatment at Mount Auburn. Oh, but I had HIV treatment at the Fenway Community Health Center. It is up to me which of those three institutional records would be available in an emergency situation. 3, 2, 1, none. Up to me.
You know, I just wonder, because a lot of us are running around doing the same thing with dentists. You have an x-rays one place and you have to bring them to the other place. Does this affect dental care too, or just... like an MD as in medical care?
So at the moment, it's focused on the delivery of medical care, but there's no reason why you can't do chiropractic, dentistry, all types of data. In fact, as we think about patients and families, there's no reason why patients shouldn't be able to contribute as well as patients be able to see all their own records. Since 1999, Beth Israel Deaconess has been sharing patient records with patients, including notes electronically.
How nervous are you? I mean, you're very positive about this, and I think in many ways you should be. The potential is huge and wonderful and convenient. But aren't you got to be nervous about some parts of this. Are you not?
Of course, we take security and privacy extraordinarily seriously. I spend $5 million a year at Beth Israel Deaconess.
I was stunned by the money. Tell people that about these different expenditures at Beth Israel Deaconess.
Sure.
Go ahead.
Sure. $5 million, 13 staff, just protecting the records, making sure that they are not accessed inappropriately by internal or external parties. So as you said, I am the CIO of Beth Israel Deaconess. I am the guardian of the Tsarnaev's medical records because not only did we receive 24 victims, but we received two perpetrators at Beth Israel Deaconess, and we protect those records with sanctity, no matter who you are.
Yep.
And so the protections I have to put in place, technological and policy protections, are extreme.
Well, you've talked about what I think is probably more common than we like to consider, especially with the elderly people. In your case, it was your grandmother who died because the physician treating her was not aware of the different drugs she was on. Is that correct?
Correct. And so I can tell you stories from almost every family member where good doctors delivering standard care had an incomplete picture of the patient's life experience and said, well, I'm going to treat you today for your problem today. Oh, well, what about the meds I'm on from the other problem? Oh, don't know about those. And so in the case of my mother, who broke her hip about a year and a half ago, she went to the emergency department, was treated quite appropriately, went into the hospital, they put her on multiple medications, didn't have access to her primary care records, and got her medications so confused that by the time I arrived in Los Angeles, she was basically sitting in a corner and mumbling. And so I had to, as a doctor, intervene to reconcile her medications and ensure that she got safe quality care. So whether it's my grandmother who was killed by a drug-drug interaction, my mother getting...
She died from a drug interaction.
She did. Yeah.
Wow.
So my mother who received too many medications, you know, my wife who had to shuttle medications, and 10 months ago my father died. And he died in an ICU and with his wishes accounted for, but only because I was carrying around pieces of paper with his advanced directives and sharing that information with every clinician. These sorts of examples shouldn't happen in a coordinated healthcare system, and that's why we launched the highway this morning.
And by the way, the way Marjorie knew about that story is Dr. Halamka has got this great blog. It's called Life as a Healthcare CIO. It's at geekdoctor.blogspot.com. So explain for us the interaction between what you just described that you say is unique to Massachusetts and this electronic health record thing that's happening nationally under the feds. Well, what's the relationship?
So the federal government came up with a three-phase plan and a very reasonable set of three phases. Let's get doctors off of paper. That's phase one. Because if you go to the doctor's office today, you'll see a sea of medical record charts often. Massachusetts is now at 80% of its doctors using electronic health records. We're probably leading the country in that first phase, better than any other state. Second phase is starting to build these healthcare exchanges. How is it that we can share data with your consent across organizations for care and care management, population health, public health? And then the third, we hope we can actually have a learning healthcare system. Well, what do I mean by that? How long did it take us to figure out that Vioxx, a medication for rheumatoid arthritis, actually caused heart attacks and strokes? Well, it took about 2 years because, one person had a problem in Massachusetts and one in Illinois and one in California, but no one was able to put all the pieces together. So that three-phase program totally aligned with what we're doing in our state of electronic health record rollout, data sharing, and then trying to build some wisdom from the data we collect.
And what role, you mentioned that there's no government role, very limited government role, except that one item you described in terms of the state thing you did this morning with Governor Patrick. What role does the federal government have in what's happening in the lower 49, well, us included, across this country? What role do the feds have?
Sure. So the feds offered incentives so that doctors and hospitals would adopt electronic records and only after they demonstrate they're using them in a meaningful way, actually achieving quality, safety, and policy goals, do they get any of the stimulus dollars. And very effective. I mean, we have gone from 20% adoption to 80% adoption. Well, it's actually about 65 in the whole United States because of this stimulus activity. Now, the federal government has also tried to set standards. Now, standards sound boring, but what if the railroad tracks of America had gauges set differently in every state? In effect, that's what we've had to deal with vendors of electronic health records. You have silos, and you can't cross boundaries. Well, the federal government has said, nope. One with. This is how it's going to work. And so the federal government's been very effective in that sort of guidance for standards.
But as Jim asked you about before, Doctor, and we should point out that we are talking with Dr. Halamka, the Chief Information Officer at Beth Israel Deaconess, who knows all about this electronic record-keeping stuff and some other things we're going to get to in a minute. But as Jim pointed out before, there's the same concern here with people saying, well, we just had this disastrous rollout, and I believe this new coding deal is supposed to be out by October, is it?
Right.
And that people are a nervous wreck that we're going to be in the same boat with the coating that we were.
Well, explain what the coating is first.
Sure. So let me start with that.
And then address the problem potential.
Well, absolutely. So for many decades, countries throughout the world have used something called the International Classification of Diseases. Do you have smallpox? Do you have polio? Do you have a trauma? How do you record the injuries or the illnesses that happen so that you epidemiologically know what's going on in society? It's a reasonable thing to do. Only America has decided to use that coding system for billing. And we've gone now in 2014 from 16,000 codes to 170,000 codes, including 52 codes specific to bird-related injuries. So that is, I have to discriminate between, say, a raven and a crow and code that correctly. Now, this may sound silly, but the idea was is that you would be able to economically reimburse more accurately if you understood the diagnosis better, avoid fraud and abuse and those sorts of things.
And if you have a patient on Medicare, talking about incentives, and you don't pick the proper code and do it within the time frame that is required, you don't get paid. Is
or
that correct?
It's fraud and abuse because as you get an audit, it would be, you didn't code really the accurate code for the visit. So what you hope is that this coding system will have certain improvements, but it requires clinical and financial systems to be retooled, doctors to be retrained. And so this period of 2014, we're adopting electronic health records, building health information exchange, changing the coding system, protecting privacy, and becoming accountable care organizations.
Isn't it kind of too much for 2014?
Well, actually, let me quote somebody who I think you've grown to respect quite a lot.
Who's
from
that?
The New York Times. Well, let me just read the quote.
Okay.
It's just this collective sum of activities that exceeds the capacity of the system to absorb it simultaneously. You know who said that?
It might have been the gentleman
It might be
right
Dr.
Across.
Halamka.
Uh-huh.
But, yeah, it was
right
you.
Now,
it
yeah.
looks like you.
It could be me.
It is too much. You're saying it yourself. It is too. This is October 1st with this coding thing.
That's
Add targeted. Forget healthcare.gov. Target 40 million people had their accounts hacked. Why are we not? And by the way, I'm all in favor of this, even though I live in great fear of it. Why are we not to be worried that our electronic health records aren't going to be hacked from wherever our target accounts were hacked?
Sure. The Office of Civil Rights has been the part of the federal government that's now enforcing privacy breaches and encouraging hospitals to implement new security measures. There have been a number of hospitals in our community that have had million-dollar fines because they have not had quite the maturity, policy, and technology they should. The Office of Civil Rights wants every person in the public to know they are the police enforcing the protections for our records. And my belief is we only have one chance to get this right. As soon as we lose faith in the systems we've built, the patients will never trust us
again. But why should we assume, despite all the fines, which obviously is an incentive to do things right, why should we assume that it's even remotely possible that we will not experience a target-like thing?
The doctors hire better technicians than the...
But somebody's not going to, and somebody's going to be rushed, even if all the intentions are good. And when the first breach comes out, that you find out that the psychiatric records or the HIV records of 17,000 people in upstate New York were hacked by somebody in Southeast Asia, it's going to sink the whole thing, is it not? It's one, bad enough to have your credit card. This is a whole different kettle of fish.
And this is a board-level issue. That is, it is the number one priority of most healthcare IT organizations. It's got visibility in the boardroom. The amount of focus organizations are putting on securing records now is very, very high. So you're right. I mean, we live in an imperfect world. Accidents can occur. But I'll tell you that hospitals are being more diligent in 2014 than they ever have been in history to keep these records secure and intact.
You know, one of the things that upset me the most about the story in which you're quoted is the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services, which in part, well, they were the supervisors of this, the IT people who blew it on healthcare.gov. Nothing, Marjorie knows this, nothing drives me more. I can tolerate a statement that I don't like about 4,000 times better than no statement. The Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services declined to be interviewed about the new codes by the New York Times. Now, what does that say to you when an entity that's intimately involved in the development of some new technology, particularly when it's our government, doesn't want to talk? That makes me very nervous. Does it make you nervous?
I think at healthcare.gov has been a wake-up call. I mean, so this may be
meaning
an example.
Don't talk to anybody?
No. I am now seeing with my colleagues in Washington attention and anxiety I've not seen before. That is reflecting on what our timelines are. We doing too much too fast? Should we revise either the deadlines or their enforcement?
Well, some people think you should.
Yeah, oh, absolutely. And there already has been one delay announced, and this program of meaningful use that I was talking about, mm-hmm. this electronic health record program. Certain deadlines in 2016 were extended to 2017, and there's more, I think, in the pipeline for reconsidering our deadlines.
Yeah, there was a great piece about this whole switching from the rather arcane system to the new computerized codes, and they talk about that there's a code for everything in this great piece in the New York Times. Injured in a spacecraft. There's a code for that.
This roughed is real,
up,
correct?
Yes. Yeah. Roughed up by an... Well, I hope so. I was going to ask the doctor that. Roughed up by an orca whale. That's in there, too. If you got drowned, if you were drowned, jumping off burning water skis, pretty unusual kinds of situations, but apparently there's codes for that. And then if you injure your big toe, with due respect to everybody who's injured a big toe, listen to this. You could have contusion of the right great toe, contusion of the left great toe, damage to the nail or without, initial encounter or subsequent encounter, blisters, abrasions, venomous insect bites, non-venomous insect bites. It goes on for about 15 more possible ways that you could hurt your toe. And you just think, this looks like, you know, overwhelming.
And so we're building new electronic systems to help doctors filter what they write into a code that's accurate. To give you an example, to your point, today, our orthopedics department has what's called a super bill of one page. It's all the codes they would typically use on one page. The new super bill would be 179 pages long if we were to include every possible variation of toe and finger injury. So we're putting in new electronic systems. Now, to your point about sequelae, subsequent, and all the rest, as you know, I run
a farm. What's sequelae?
Oh, a consequence.
Oh, okay.
So I'm now showing you my finger. This is a chicken injury to my finger.
What's the code
sequelae
for that?
Sequelae.
Exactly.
I think it's an E951.72.
Hey, before we get to use your line, before we went on the air from Obamacare to Llamacare, you and your farm in a second there, Dr. Halamka, how are the providers, I mean, the actual on-the-ground providers, doctors and nurses feeling about this? The best, I have had a lot of great doctors in my life. One of my favorites, if not my all-time favorite, quit the profession for years because she couldn't deal with the bureaucracy anymore, and she's now back in a more limited capacity. This sounds like bureaucracy to the nth degree, even if ultimately we benefit by the, I'm talking about the codes, by the specificity. How do they feel about having to the perfect degree identify the proper code, and if they don't, they won't get paid?
And the answer is they're begging for IT help. Now, yeah. Beth Israel Deaconess is an interesting organization in that we build our own IT systems. Doctors build systems for doctors, nurses for nurses, pharmacists for pharmacists. And so as doctors say, my workflow is now going mm-hmm. to be so significantly impacted, let's together build a system that allows me to type what it is I'm doing or dictate, and then the computer helps me figure out what code is correct, reducing the burden on all.
But before we move on to the farm, though, I just want to – why do we need a code for people to get injured in spacecrafts? I mean, there's not very many of us getting injured in spacecrafts.
Well, if suddenly, you know, Skylab has already fallen. But let's say it's the
Virgin
International
Spaces
or something. You know, the public health folks would like to know where in the United States such things happen in the interest of preventing harm in the future.
Okay.
It may sound slightly ridiculous, but it does help us from a public health and fraud and abuse perspective. Okay.
You know, to move this thing along, my apologies to Steve from Framingham. I'm not going to take the call, but the issue he raises is a great one, which I wish we had thought of. What happens when incorrect information is input for the first time, and then another provider accesses that information with your consent, and then another provider, and so this incorrect information is in 11 different places, again, with your consent? What's the answer to Steve from Framingham's question?
Right, so Beth Israel Deaconess and many organizations offer a personal health record that allow you to glimpse at all the data and then you working through a process to correct information that you find that's inaccurate. It is very common for a doctor to hear something and record it. It's not precisely right, and for patients to add amendments to it.
Would that corrected information then be sent to every provider who sought and successfully received information about you from them?
Right. So it would be at any future query, any amendments you add would be available.
Well, I'm not talking about a future query. I'm talking about a past query that included the incorrect information. It's corrected subsequently. Would it be sent out to that other place so that their records are updated as well?
And at least the way we've architected this is that the data doesn't actually leave the hospital. It's viewed by the receiving doctor and not incorporated into their local record.
Oh, it's viewed. Oh, it's not saved at that location.
Correct.
So that next time they went back to get it for the next visit, they'd get the updated information.
Okay, let's hear about this farm. You've got 100 animals on this farm. Here you are running around doing all this stuff with the governor, and you got your job at Beth Israel, and you're a very busy guy, and your wife, I'm sure, is a very busy woman. You've got 100 animals on this farm,
and
you're taking
about?
Care of them with you and your wife.
Right, so there's nothing better than shoveling manure at 4 a.m. to build equanimity.
You That's know? My motto.
You know? So this morning at the farm, it was 3 degrees.
Oh, God.
In fact, if you ever look at your iPhone for the town of Sherburne, Massachusetts.
Yes, I know it.
I actually operate the weather station for Sherburne, Massachusetts. So your iPhone
is really
showing
true?
Unity Farm weather.
Wow.
So you're looking at the temperature on my barn.
Oh, God. Well, how is it in your barn? I mean, and how are these animals doing in this cold weather?
Well, so llamas and alpacas are from the Andes.
Yes.
And so they're actually quite used to cold temperatures, yep. but they're used to dry weather, very dry in the Andes. So they don't really like deep snow. So what you'll find, 3 degrees, no problem. But deep snow, I'm out there with shovels and snow blowers cutting them paths.
And what is the allure? Are you a farm boy or what's the deal here, doctor?
There's probably two ways to think about that. I was born in Iowa.
Oh,
so, really?
Yes. As was one of our great producers, yes. by the way.
And so, you know, you could take the boy out of Iowa, but you can't take Iowa out of the boy. And so there's that. But mostly, there is a great contrast between living in a high-tech, interconnected world
yes.
and caring for ducks and guinea fowl and chickens and Great Pyrenees. Mm-hmm. And the amount of relief that I receive from this, you know, Twitterverse that we live in when I'm out at 4 a.m. shoveling manure is immense. This is why I'm an emergency physician in addition to a CIO, and you may notice I have a certain calmness.
You do. You do. I guess the rest of us should shovel manure more often. We
exactly.
might be more calm.
Chop
but how much time does this take to manage this farm? Because you've got to feed the animals. You've got to clean the animals. You've got to get...
Well, how about in freezing cold weather?
That's
the extra
right.
burdens that you write about on
exactly.
your blog.
What time do you go to bed at night? Do you get up at 4 o'clock in the morning to feed
these? I do sleep 4 or so hours a night, which helps.
Yeah.
Have since the age of 18. But you'll find in the morning I'm out doing the cleaning and the feeding. And then in the evening I'm doing the feeding. And then weekends are when I do quite a lot of the heavier chores. And my wife, of course, fills in where I can't if I'm traveling. And so far, so good.
So how much time a day?
So it's about 2 hours
wow.
a day. But then most of the weekend time. And people say, well, hey, it's the weekend. I say, well, I'm a farmer. There's no difference between a weekday, a night, a weekend. I'm a farmer.
So do all the animals live through the frost?
They are all in perfect health.
Good
health
for you,
right
that's...
now. And I do have heaters in the coops and heated water buckets to the other question that was asked by another listener.
Yes, we had a woman with horses.
I do everything.
Hammer the ice.
I use heated water buckets.
That's a very nice idea.
Keep the water at 40 degrees.
So most of them are okay. Will they huddle together?
They will.
Yeah.
And so llamas and alpacas keep each other warm.
Okay, let's move from the farm to one last thing, because we're actually going to discuss this with our listeners in a couple of seconds. Have you heard of this invention called the ticker, T-I-K-K-E-R?
I have not.
It is a death watch. And what it does is there's a website and there's a watch that's going to be available for $59 allegedly come April, where you will fill out a form which allows you to calculate how long you're going to live. And many of us have done this. I've gone on to those forms to find out, you know, how you're going to live based on your exercise pattern and your health and your parents and whatever. But unlike that, where you forget it or choose to forget it, as soon as this has your life expectancy on your wrist, on your watch, and it does a countdown. So if you're going to live 30 more years, for argument's sake, it says 29 years, 11 months, 29 days, 9 hours, and whatever. And so, and the reason we're even bringing it up with you is the last line on your life care as a health care CIO says living life to its fullest, which happens to be the exact same motto, coincidentally, of Ticker, the death
That's
watch.
Right.
They don't call it the death watch. We do. What's your take on this? Is this a healthy exercise for people to engage in?
Personal story for you. So I'm now 52. When I was 40, I weighed 70 pounds more than I do now.
Really?
Wow.
And why? Because I had the high-stress CIO, double-size this and latte that kind of diet.
My kind of guy.
Yeah. So I went to my doctor and said, I probably need some help. He said, oh, we'll put you on ACE inhibitors, beta blockers, Lipitor, $700 a month of metabolic poisons. You'll be fine.
Ah.
And I said, this is probably a lifestyle problem. He said, oh, yeah, but you'll lose 25 pounds, gain 35. Very, very hard to lose weight. I became vegan. And so I have been a strict vegan now for 12 years. and I haven't gained or lost a pound since the 70-pound weight loss. And
wow.
So my body mass index stays around 21. So I think of it this way, is that if I eat right and I exercise and I am doing those things with the world that I hope is making a difference, I'm living every day to the fullest. And
so you don't need the watch?
Yeah.
If I bought you the watch, would you wear the watch?
No. You know, I could be struck by lightning tomorrow or a spacecraft.
That's right. If you're farming 2 hours a day, too, that's good exercise.
It is very good exercise. And so we also have 15 acres of woods. And so I have 8 cords of wood that I mount everything by hand. And so far, my upper body has gained a bit of strength being a farmer.
I bet it has. You're chopping that wood.
Exactly.
And how happy are all his chickens and ducks that he's a vegan, by the way? They smile every time Dr. Halamka walks by. Doctor, it was a pleasure talking to you. Thanks so much for your
time. This has been wonderful. Dr. Halamka is the Chief Information Officer at Beth Israel Deaconess Center. You should also check out his fantastic blog, Life as a Healthcare CIO. Thanks again for joining us. When we come back, we're going to ask you guys the same question we asked the doctor. If you could, would you want to know when you're going to die? Would it change the way you live your life? There's now a watch, ticker, that serves as the ultimate countdown. That conversation next on 89.7 WGBH.
Around here, January means the start of another season of Downton Abbey on Masterpiece. And if you love checking in with the English aristocracy from the comfort of your sofa, how about experiencing the real thing? WGBH Learning Tours presents England Upstairs, the World of the Gentry. You'll fly to England for 10 days, explore the world of the lords and ladies, and even be invited to Highclere Castle. Space is extremely limited. Details at wgbh.org/learningtours.
This program is on WGBH thanks to you and Mass Art Professional and Continuing Education, where you can get creative, get dirty, get involved. Registering now for winter and spring classes in art and design. massart.edu/CE. And the law firm of Nutter, McLennan & Fish, providing counsel to companies and institutions for more than a century and proud to support WGBH. Innovative, dedicated, responsive. This is Nutter. On the web at nutter.com.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. So if today were the last day of your life, would it change the way you live? The idea that we should live each day like it was our last is a good one. It can serve as a sobering way of checking ourselves. Would we really get that upset about petty things if we knew our time was running out? Wouldn't we treat people with more generosity and understanding? We probably would, but it's really hard to sustain that lofty worldview until now. And we just mentioned this to the doctor. A new watch, it's called Ticker, T-I-K-K-E-R, claims to have created a way to calculate approximately when you are likely to die. You do an interview, you fill out a form, etc., you input all this data. Then they input that date into your wristwatch, and then the countdown begins. The purpose is to constantly remind you of your own mortality, and ideally it will nudge you to live life to the fullest, as we said a minute ago. And we want to know, we only have a few minutes here, would you buy such a watch? Would you wear such a watch? Would seeing the seconds, minutes, hours of your life passing by change the way you live? Look at the look on Marjorie's face. 877-301-8970. As I said to Dr. Halamka, I've gone to those sites. I don't know if you ever have, where you type in all the stuff, information, and you find out you're going to live to your 80, whatever, that sort of thing. But you know what the difference is there? When you finish with that site, it's in the back of your head, but it's gone, essentially. Here is something that would be on your wrist every day, theoretically to motivate you to live a calmer life, a more generous life, a more outcome-focused life. But it would be a constant reminder every time you look down that you have a diminishing number of moments
on
this earth. 877-301-8970. Would you buy a ticker when it's available? It's only $59 in April. Or is it something you have no interest in knowing anything about?
Would you do it?
I really don't know. Because I have, you know, my initial reaction was no, but I've gone to those sites. I probably go once every 6 months to check. No, see if there's a difference, you know, if they've changed the rules.
Once every 6 days.
No, and then I do. And then then when you don't get the outcome, when they only say you're going to live till you're 79, then you fudge some of the inputs. And you amazingly live till you're 81.
Well,
then you become a vegan on the website. You live till you're 84, that sort of thing.
You might change your habits, though. I would dare say if you bought one of these watches, you know how if you get in a little scuffle in traffic and you insist upon following the person to Ohio? you might not do that.
Well, that's exactly right, which I have almost done in the past. The ticker on their website is, I hate the term bucket list, bucket list. You'd tell everyone that you love them. You might skydive. I'm not doing that. You'd only eat things you really like. You know, help people in need, buy dogs, that sort of thing. We want to know if you would do this or if this is something you'd stay away from.
Shouldn't buy a dog before you're going to die.
What? Well, what if it says you're going to live for 42 years?
Oh,
well, at least
okay.
You know.
That's different.
Well, the assumption is it's not going to say you're leaving this yeah. planet tomorrow. Let's go to Rhode Island and start there with Sean. Sean, you're next on Boston Public Radio. Hey, Sean. Hey, Sean. Oops, sorry. My fault, Sean. Hi.
Hi, how are you?
Excellent.
Good.
So are you going to buy a ticker or no?
No, that's a silly invention. I think the guy's making money off it, obviously.
Obviously.
I wake up daily, and I thank God for letting me wake up. I'm not an old guy. I thank him for letting me wake up, and I live the day. You know, I live through the day, and when I'm done, I thank God for letting me make it another day.
Listen to this guy's
okay,
voice.
You're very together,
how
Sean.
Great
how'd
is
you
Sean?
Get, how'd you get that way, Sean?
Well, I live by spiritual principle. You know, I think that we should just kind of try to. I'm not religious in any way. I just think we should live by spiritual principles.
Yeah, you 12-step guy.
Yeah,
yeah.
You picked up on that, huh?
Yeah, I did.
I just think that people put too much emphasis on stupid stuff. You know, and be thankful that you woke up.
I love this
guy.
You
know, you can get hit by a car, you can get hit by lightning, you can get hit by a buffalo crossing the road.
I don't think I'm going to get hit by a buffalo. The other stuff's possible. Hey, Sean, I wish I could be more like you. Thank you so much for the call. Jay in the car, you're next on Boston Public Radio. We're talking about the ticker, the new watch that counts down your time, approximate time, till you're about to disappear. Hi, Jay.
Hi. Thank you very much for taking the call.
Thank you.
Absolutely, I would wear this.
You would? Why?
Absolutely, because I think that it makes you question every decision that you would make. So say, for example, if I'm getting upset with my daughter for something that she did, I'm going to take one quick look at that watch and say, you know what, is it really worth it? Do I take the time to talk with her instead of getting upset and flying off the handle?
You know, by the way, Jay, your perspective on this is very much like Chelsea, our colleague here. I was thinking about, you know, all the great things you're going to do that you've never done, places you'd visit. But you're talking about more about how you'd live your life in an everyday way, as was she. And as Marjorie said, you don't get as aggravated when someone cuts you off in traffic. That's probably the more helpful thing. And I think that's a good attitude. So, Jay, without the watch, you're going to get aggravated at your kid. Is that the bottom line?
Absolutely.
Yeah, I knew that. Jay, thank you for the call.
Mark has a good email. He points out that he would wear the watch because at least then he'd know when not to buy any more green bananas.
It's an old line, but it's a good line. Let's go to Cambridge. Beth is on the phone. Beth, you're next on Boston Public Radio. Hey.
Hey, thanks for having me on.
Hi.
I think it's kind of a novelty item because it records the data at a static point in your life.
That's true.
When you actually could be making changes. So let's say we did the input today and it said you have 29 years to live. Well, what if I put that watch on and it started to monitor things like blood pressure and other sort of things that I've improved because I exercise more, for example? Well, then all of a sudden you have sort of a better dynamic case of like, oh, wow, you know what? Last year when I was kind of, you know, not really taking care of myself, I had 29 years. I have 30 years because I'm actually doing better things on a daily basis to improve my health.
Well, I think the answer is you buy a new watch. That's about I am guessing. I don't work for the company. My assumption is if you dramatically change your behavior in a way that would affect all the stuff that you've input into the system that allows them to make the calculation, I am guessing they download in your watch or upload in your watch a different, end date or whatever it is. But so, Beth, would you buy one if they had that adjustment capacity?
I think if it had sort of an adjustable expiration date, that would be actually something that would be interesting.
When you say expiration date, do not use after such and such a date. That's what it says.
Well, you know,
Beth, thanks.
When you look at the face of the watch, at least on its website, it gives you the years you have left. The example is 54 years, then 9 months, then 22 days, 19 hours, 55 minutes, and 3 seconds.
Yeah, when it gets really low, you get rid of the watch. Incidentally, if you go to the website, here's a little promo video for the watch. Just listen to what they have to say about themselves. It's brief. Listen.
Seconds, days, and years are passing never to come again. Make the right choices. Anger or forgiveness? Tick-tock. Wearing a frown or a smile? Tick-tock. Happy or upset? Tick-tock. That's why we've created Ticker, the death watch that counts down your life.
Shut up with the TikTok
death
thing.
Death watch that counts TikTok. Down your life. I know. Do we
can only squeeze one more in. Yeah, quickly.
Real quick. We'll go to Jean in Fort Lauderdale. Hi, Jean.
Hi, Jean.
Hi.
Hi.
I'm going to be 69 next week.
Yeah.
And I'm retired in Fort Lauderdale and on Cape Cod in the summer. I have a great life. Me and my friends, we're wearing this watch all the time in our minds.
You mean in your head? Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
In our heads.
Yeah.
We see our friends get sick. We see people die every day. And we're so happy that we're all there. We're going out for dinner tonight. We celebrate it every minute.
Hey, Jean, what's the temperature in Fort Lauderdale, Jean?
We've having a cold snap, so it's down in the 60s. But
I knew
it's
down in the 60s. Okay.
They'd like to, those people in Florida like to see us in pain. Jean, thank you.
Okay.
For the cold. But, you know, Jean makes a good point. I mean, and the first caller made it about living every life every day as if it were your last, to the fullest, all that
How
sort of thing.
How could you live every day like it's your last? You wouldn't do anything. Would you come to work in the day? I mean, you would do it your whole life differently. You spend, I don't know what you do, but
so
you
So why wouldn't
doing...
you buy a watch then? So it would basically put everything in context
I don't
for
like
you.
That expression, live every day like it's your last.
What do you like? What do you like? What expression do you like?
I don't know, Jim. TikTok.
Live life to its fullest. Don't say TikTok. I hate that. I don't like TikTok in life. I don't like TikTok in the promo for the thing. I don't like
Okay, when we come back, we're going to continue the Downton Abbey conversation we started with Nancy Kane yesterday with TV expert Bob Thompson. He's on next to talk British period dramas and the new movement, wait to hear about this, called Slow TV. Stick around to find out what that's about up next on 89.7 WGBH.
Next time on The World, it's 1970. Chef James Beard and food writer MFK Fisher are hanging out in France with Julia Child.
She wants to do different things. She's ready to do a New England clam chowder. She wants to do an Indian curry. She wants to try different kinds of food other than this French cooking.
Recalling a turning point in American food culture, Provence, 1970. Next time on The World.
This afternoon at 3 here on WGBH Radio.
Funding for our programs comes from you and AAA Southern New England, helping and serving members for more than 110 years with roadside assistance, insurance and financial products, and a full-service travel agency. Details at AAA.com. AAA, membership for life. And the Massachusetts Teachers Association, reminding you that learning doesn't just happen in the classroom. It happens all day, every day. Working together, parents and teachers can make this a successful school year for every child in Massachusetts.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Jim Browdy and Marge Regan. And this is something people have waited 11 months to hear.
You have a straightforward choice before you. You must choose either death or life.
He's not an orphan. He's got his mother.
It's getting harder and harder to say no.
Say nothing and I'll be your friend forever.
It's time for you to come back to us.
I'm so pleased seeing the old house at full strength again.
Downton Abbey on Masterpiece.
Oh, be still my heart. That, of course, is the trailer to season 4 of Downton Abbey. It returned to TV earlier this week. So did the Downton Abbey die along with Matthew Crowley? Or like Mary, will the show choose to persevere in his absence? Maybe the test will be if President Obama keeps Downton Abbey on his must-see TV list. Joining us to take on this television news, among other developments, is Bob Thompson. As you know, Bob is the founding director of the Bleier Center for Television and Popular Culture and a trustee professor of TV and popular culture at the Newhouse School of Public Communications at Syracuse. Bob, Happy New Year. Good to talk to you.
Happy New Year to you, too.
Hi, Bob. Thanks for joining us. So there were some mixed reviews going into the fourth season premiere at Downton Abbey. I saw most of it on Sunday. I was just like sucked right back in as usual.
Yeah, I was too, and it's amazing how this can happen after 11 months. I guess it's sort of like friendships with people that you've been good friends with them, and then they move away and they're gone for a long time, and the minute they come back for a while, you're right back into the relationship as though nothing had ever changed. 11 months is a long time, and that's happening with a lot of these short season serialized things. But I think it was after that traumatic ending to the last season. It starts back up 6 months later and got, I think, right back the kind of lathery soap that is so good at
doing. The gorgeous Dan Stevens, you know, who played the young husband, Matthew. He just saw his brand new baby with Lady Mary. Gets into those old cars, whatever you call those cars they drove, looking so gorgeous with his blonde hair in the wind. And then he's like dead with the blood coming out of his ear. It was very upsetting.
Not like dead, Marjorie.
He was totally dead.
You know,
he's on Broadway now, I guess, somewhere, isn't he? Isn't that where he's gone?
Bob, I worry that my GBH contract will be terminated when I say this, but I will throw caution to the wind. I'd never watched more than 15 minutes of Downton Abbey until this past Sunday. And
wow.
I have to say, I know, even though there were moments that were, in my opinion, Monty Python-esque, it is spectacular. For someone like me, you don't know me except through the radio, who is not into this kind of timepiece. This is 1922. What sucks people like me in?
I think it's that it's a combination of two things we don't often see. The first is it is a good old-fashioned dishy soap. I mean, the pleasure I get out of Downton Abbey reminds me of the pleasures I used to get out of Melrose Place and Knott's Landing and shows like that. And what's so interesting about Downton Abbey is you keep almost wanting to kick yourself that, wait a second, is this really on my PBS station? Because you get to feel like you're smart because you're watching this British period piece.
That's right.
And at the same time, you get to watch some good old-fashioned soap opera kind of stuff. And I think that makes a delicious combination in this case.
Well, you know what it also is for me? It's like this fascinating era when people lived in these 75-room estates and they had, 50 people.
It's like Tom Brady and Giselle Bundchen,
essentially. Yeah, I mean, I was watching, this shows what an addict I am, the lead-up to Downton Abbey last night, and they were talking about these, these real-time estates and how there are so few of them now in England, and how one weekend when the Prince of Wales, Edward, that ran off with Wallace Simpson came to spend the weekend. It was Edward, right? That was the Prince of Wales? I think that was his name. Anyway, it cost in real money like $500,000 to feed the royal family for the weekend with what you had to pay the help and the food and the extravagance and the liquor and all that kind of stuff. It was a time of this sort of excess, which, you really, I guess you do see it among the super rich and in everywhere, but not in this kind of detail.
And not with this literary density. I mean, I suppose you see some of that lifestyles of the rich and famous in some of these goofy reality shows, although not to this extent. But here you get that as well as all of this really nicely crafted, acted sort of stuff. You know, it reminds me, when I was growing up, I watched The Brady Bunch. One bathroom, six kids.
That's right.
And here you've got I don't know how many rooms per capita. But it's also a little bit reminiscent of shows like, remember The Love Boat? You're kind of on this big thing, and there's all this help and food and whatever, and then you throw people onto it, and you see how the chemicals react with each other. Downton Abbey is a lot like that. It's this big place, sort of at sea, somewhere in the United Kingdom during some really turbulent times, and they've got a lot of really good stuff to work with. After all, doesn't this show start with the sinking of the Titanic, if I remember back?
That's right. That's right.
Correctly?
Speaking of Titanic and boats, you're probably the only television analyst who has ever used the term Love Boat and Downton Abbey in the same sentence, Bob
and
Thompson.
And got to slip Titanic in there, too. Exactly. I didn't even realize I was doing that one.
Hey, Bob, before we leave Downton Abbey, you started by mentioning the 11-month hiatus, which is one of the things we've discussed with you before that drives me nuts with all these series, that they're not predictable. They don't come on in September. We don't have X number of episodes. This is apparently not turning off anybody, the unpredictability. Is it or is it?
It doesn't seem to, and I'm kind of surprised. I mean, first of all, it's one of the prices we pay. One of the reasons these shows are so good is that there's not so many of them. It's easier to churn out 13 episodes of The Wire or The Sopranos or Downton Abbey or whatever every year, or sometimes even every year and a half, than it is to churn out, back in the really old days of television, the 50s, there was 39 episodes per season of programs, 22 as we got further along. So part of it is one of the reasons the shows are so good is that this happens. I thought people would simply forget about it. And it did have some problems with shows like Lost and a few others. But they seem to be able to come right back. And this reminds me, remember who shot J.R.?
Oh, yes.
J.R. got shot in March, if I'm not mistaken. And then there was a writer's strike or some such thing. And I don't believe we found out who shot J.R. until November. That was, what, close to 8 months, which isn't that much different than 11. So I think people are able to sort of put these things on pause. And when they start up again, go along with it. Though I have to admit, when I started up this season of Homeland, I'd totally forgotten what had happened.
Yeah, but tell me you are not counting the days until Benedict Cumberbatch goes back on as the great Sherlock Holmes and one of the great Sherlock Holmesian portrayals ever. You love it, I hope.
Okay, I'm counting the days for that.
Oh, you are. It's great,
oh,
right?
Oh, you've made Jim very happy.
January 19th, but who's counting? Now, one person who was not watching last night apparently was Barack Obama. We learn in a New York Times piece. I knew about the Homeland thing. He is binge-watching Breaking Bad. He loves House of Cards, which is Game of Thrones.
Yeah, I
was
surprised.
One of the most violent things ever on television. Were you surprised by the view list of the most powerful person in the world?
Well, for one thing, I think maybe he's not telling us everything, because most of this stuff is pretty classy stuff. Even Games of Thrones, you're right, they end of last toward the end of last season, they took out half their cast. But still, it's kind of one of these classy, cable kinds of things. Barack Obama's view list reminds me of someone about 25 years ago who, when you said, what's your favorite TV show, they'd say, oh, all I watch is the McNeil Lehrer Report.
That's right.
Kind of thing. But no, it doesn't surprise me in that even though he is the president of the United States, he's also a human being like you and I, one of our fellow citizens. And I look at that list of stuff he's watching and is excited about, and there are things that a lot of us, including myself, are excited about. House of Cards, he's looking forward to that coming back. So am I. There were only 13 episodes of that. Game of Thrones is a little different, but it's a very compelling program. He seems to have a view list that's similar to the kind of highbrow viewer of today in general.
And
I'm not
of
sure if it's going to get him votes. He ought to put some other things on there to get some of the blue states.
But this great piece in the New York Times talking about this.
The red states, I mean, sorry.
Well, he watches SportsCenter. I mean, that counts, right?
He does watch SportsCenter. That's right. And he also likes, Modern Family and Parks and Rec, of all things.
Allegedly, yes.
But a lot of other stuff,
right.
A lot of other stuff he likes is pretty violent.
Exactly.
And the Times piece made a point of saying that, his day job, obviously, is all about violence here, all around the world, these terrible catastrophes, and yet that's what he watches in his spare time. I love the fact that the same piece talked to ask Bill Clinton, since he left office, what his favorite shows were, and he said, of course, 24, and then ABC's Scandal.
Yeah.
I mean, how perfect was that?
Well, that would be a whole that's a whole other conversation. But,
Bob, you reminded. It's funny you say when you talk to someone like Barack Obama, you're not sure if these are the shows he or she really watches or what they think they're supposed to watch. We spent an hour in the studio right before the Scott Brown Elizabeth Warren election with Elizabeth Warren before she was senator, and before the interview, I said, Marjorie, I'm going to catch her.
Oh yeah,
I'm going to ask her what's her favorite television show that is not on PBS, and she's not going to have any, and it's going to be a scandal. Well, I ask her the question, and without missing a beat, she says Homeland. So I'm saying to myself, obviously she picked this because the president has his favorite show. So I go in for the kill, Bob Thompson. And I say, tell me what episode was your favorite, knowing she had never seen it.
Oh, yeah.
She knew more detail about Homeland than Claire Danes knew about Homeland.
It was great.
It was really.
Which may not be saying much. Claire Danes forgets a lot of what happened in Homeland.
That's a very good point. One last thing about since Homeland is on his list, I got an email last night from a friend, speaking of someone you haven't talked to in a while, saying you've got to watch Prisoners of War, which is the Israeli show which Homeland is based upon. Have you ever seen it?
I have seen just a little bit of it, and that is on my list of something I want to watch because I keep getting that same email from people.
Okay, well, let us know. Well, speaking of Obama and binge viewing of Breaking Bad, I'm in the midst of I spent most of my Christmas vacation binge viewing The Good Wife, which I really think is terrific, even though I think it'd be better had it been on cable. What do you think? I mean, I assume some shows lend themselves to binge viewing and some don't. To the uninitiated, if someone says to you, what are the two or three things you should absolutely binge view and what are the one or two or three things you probably shouldn't? What's on both lists for Bob Thompson?
Well, I think good sitcoms are not good for binge viewing. I mean, two or three is one thing, but there is no reason that you need to watch. Yeah. The Dick Van Dyke Show was a great show. I don't think you need to watch 10 episodes in a row. I think the rule of thumb is the serialized stuff is good for binge viewing. The not serialized stuff isn't as necessary to do it, even though we've got these long marathons of CSI. There's no reason to watch those over and over again. It's interesting you bring up Good Wife, which I know it's been getting nominated for Emmys. It's been getting a lot of attention, but I think that show actually deserves more critical attention than it's getting. It's this past season, they did a string of two or three episodes when the whole firm was really kind of imploding that I think was some of the best television I had seen all year. And that's saying something because it was a lot of really good TV on this year. They were the ones that ran in October and into November. And that's one of those shows, if you've already kind of caught up with the, you know, the cliches, Breaking Bad and Homeland and all of those kinds of things, Good Wife would be a good second tier to get into. And also, there's an awful lot of people, this gets us back to Obama's list, who may not have gone back and watched all five seasons of The Wire. Obama always tells us he thinks it's one of the greatest shows ever made. I agree with the president on that, and that's a wonderful show to binge view on.
You know, it's a wonderful show because I think you don't
– where
else
about?
Do you see the nitty-gritty of that very tough life? I mean, it's just – maybe it's out there, but if it is, I'm not aware of it. And it really
right. The president pointed that out too. It's the other America.
Exactly.
Exactly.
And you know, explains so much of our domestic, you know, the dysfunction that you see in some of the urban city neighborhoods. It's fantastic.
You know, back to The Good Wife, just for a second. I just finished season two a couple of days ago. What is it? Juliana Margolis is the star,
right?
And there's just some. It's great. But when you watch this, and when you've spent the last 15 years of your life, as we all have, watching cable television. My only criticism of the show, and I think it's terrific. I think it's scripted great. Not that I know, but the acting is great. The casting is great. You sort of feel at critical moments that it really should be on cable, whether it's the language or the lack of, I don't know, full range of emotions. Do you ever get that feeling when you're watching even a great broadcast network show?
Yes, I do. And it's an interesting dilemma. And it's one, of course, that the networks resent the fact that they're not playing on an even playing field. For one thing, one of the things I admire about The Good Wife is that it's able to pull off what it does by not being on cable.
Yeah.
It's almost
true.
Like a show like that on broadcast network is showing off to even try such a thing, as opposed to just be another reality show. And I think in most cases, and Good Wife may be one, you're probably right. It would be able to work with a much larger palette if it were on cable. Though I think there have been a few shows that were better on network TV than they were on cable.
Like what?
One of them, I think, was The West Wing. Mm. The West Wing, by not being able to have all that bad language, by not being able to do what it could have done in cable, was forced to become such a sort of hyper-stylized kind of thing. And I think that would have actually suffered if it had had the limitations it had on cable. And maybe Lost would be the other one that I think probably was better on network than on cable. Other than that, I can't think of too many.
We should just say, we've been talking about it with exultation. For those few who don't know, Good Wife is a story. It opens with a couple where the wife has just found out that her husband, who's the state's attorney, is in jail.
That's right.
Because he...
former star of Sex and the City.
Right, exactly.
Mr. Big.
He's quite good in this, by the way. He's in jail
because
he was involved with a prostitute and he allegedly used state money. And it's their relationship and her work at the law firm. And he gets out of jail, and I won't tell you what the deal is. But it's really terrific.
We're talking with Bob Thompson, the founding director of the Blyer Center for Television and Popular Culture at Syracuse University. I want to ask you about this phenomenon, which Jim and I just read about this morning, and it's fascinating, this slow TV thing that's going on in Norway, I guess, is really big into it. Explain it to our listeners, please, Bob.
Yeah, well, slow TV, and I guess this has been done before. Anyway, what it is apparently it's just cameras set stationary on events going on. And I'm not talking about events like wrestling matches and things exploding. Events like, women knitting.
Yeah.
That kind of thing. And when you think about it, this isn't new as a phenomenon. It's just new as something that we'd be doing a lot of. Andy Warhol did that film, what was it called, Empire, I think, which was just a static shot of the Empire State Building. And we in this country are mostly familiar with a famous kind of slow TV long before it was ever called that, which is the Yule log. Remember those?
Oh, of course. Right.
Various
exactly.
Various stations would put on, and you'd have it as background music or background visuals over the holidays if you didn't have a real fireplace.
That's right.
And slow TV has got some of that. The one I watched, which I think was a promotional thing, was just a camera mounted in the front of a train. And it was like 10 straight minutes of a train going through snowy landscapes. It's not something I would sit down and watch, but I have to say, as a moving poster on the wall, it was kind of interesting.
You know what they said in this?
Our producer just said in our ear,
what?
Maybe people in Colorado are going to start watching it because of the law
pot,
change there.
Yeah, the pot thing.
You know, don't go away yet.
That's a very good insight to tell you the truth.
But you know, I guess I don't really get. They talked about in this piece about how in Norway, where there's only 5 million people, can that possibly be true? That anyway, there were 1.2 million viewers out of 5 million people watching this train ride.
Wait, 3 million watched the cruise ship.
Yeah. I mean, I guess and everybody's kind of watching it together.
Well, there's a couple of things, though, we have to look at. Number one, what does it mean by watching? When they give you those statistics, that means whatever their rating system is showed that was on.
Okay, the TV was on. It's a great point.
Right. So I think this is the kind of thing that I'm not sure there's too many people who darken the lights and sit there and watch it, though there may be a few. So the second thing is I think there is a novelty factor. But when you're at home, a lot of people have sort of a default channel they go to while they're diapering the kid and answering the door and doing all the stuff that the home is requiring to be done. And in that sense, I could see how something like this could become a popular default channel, especially if they put it's all ultimately dull because nothing much happens, but you can choose interesting dull things and not so interesting. By the way, remember, we're living in a country that managed to turn competitive poker, card playing, into a hit TV genre.
Yeah, but I have to say, I have to critique your own analysis of this slow TV thing. I mean, you compare it to the Warhol thing, Bob Thompson, and to, what was the other thing? To the Yule log. Listen to this description for a second. The 4 minute and 4 hour and 51, multi-hour thing on knitting. You know, it isn't like nothing happens. Here's what, 7 spinners and knitters hunker down, the story says, to stitch a large men's sweater. And here's what the lead producer says, the executive producer, it will be hard to take a break. We will broadcast until the sweater is finished. I mean, it's sort of like the Dallas thing you talked about a couple.
Don't forget what happens at the end.
What does?
They trot out the sheep at midnight.
Oh, they do. I forgot about that.
And its wool is spun into yarn.
I could definitely do this.
That's the sort of dramatic denouement.
It could be huge. And by the way, it costs almost nothing to produce, a la reality television. And apparently, you know that old saying, as goes Norway, so goes the United States. You know that, Bob?
Hell yeah, yeah.
Hey,
no, I have that knitted, in fact, in a little sampler hanging up in my bedroom.
So is this coming here?
Well, there's enough cable channels that I could see stuff. I mean, there's so much specialized stuff that I could see that we could experiment with something like this. Whether or not, and because it is so incredibly cheap, you set a camera up on a tripod and you push record. And it is true. In the end of one of these, you do get a sweater. At the end of Yule log, you didn't even get a burnt log. It was on a loop, and you didn't even manage to consume the fuel of the log itself. I think this kind of thing, though, will always be a novelty of sorts. I don't think we're going to have people waiting 11 months with bated breath for the next season of a cable knit sweater.
No, I don't think so either.
Maybe a scarf, but not a sweater. Hey, Bob,
Bob
thanks.
Thompson, Happy New Year, and thanks for being with us.
Happy New Year to you, too. Thank you.
Thank you. Love to talk to you. Bob Thompson is the founding director of the Bleier Center for Television and Popular Culture and a trustee professor of television and popular culture at the Newhouse School of Public Communications at Syracuse University. How much fun is it to talk to him?
He's great. Terrific. There are a lot of great people today.
Slow TV is in my future, I can tell. Thank you guys for listening to another edition of Boston Public Radio. Tune in tomorrow for Open Mic with Alex Beam from the Boston Globe. We're also going to check in with Suffolk Law Professor Renee Landers on the latest cases facing the Supreme Court. One of them, of course, is this big brouhaha over contraception care and Obamacare.
Well, also, we're going to do one case from the highest court in Massachusetts. It's the controversial decision around Christmas that sentencing a juvenile murderer to life without parole violated the state constitution, that they have to have a parole hearing, including some of the most heinous crime committers as teens after 15 years.
Including that young man that's 14 years old that is facing
Philip
charges.
Philip Chisholm.
That's
for killing
right.
Colleen
for killing
Ritzer.
His
well, she hasn't been convicted, but it would apply
accused.
To him. That's
He's
right.
accused
yeah.
of killing his teacher. Anyway, our show is a production of WGBH, Boston Public Radio. Our production team, Chelsea Merz, Will Roselip, Amanda McGowan, and John Parker. I am Marjorie Egan.
I'm Jim Browdy. You can follow me at Jim Browdy on Twitter. You can follow Marjorie at Marjorie Egan. You can follow our show at BOS Public Radio.
Thanks for listening, and thanks. I hope you tune in tomorrow.